This week on Retronauts, knowing is half the battle. Hello, and welcome to Retronauts episode 550, by my reckoning. I am your special guest host, video game historian Kevin Bunch, and I'm here today with some fine folks from the Video Game History Foundation to talk about their really rad study that just got published earlier this month about retro game availability. So I guess we'll start in alphabetical order. Who wants to introduce themselves around the table?
I guess that's me. I'm Kelsey Lewin. I'm co-director of the Video Game History Foundation. And I don't know if I need more introduction than that.
And I'm Phil Salvador. I am the library director at the Video Game History Foundation and was the main author on this report.
Thank you for coming on. So I guess the first question everyone coming onto this podcast is going to have is, what is this project and why is it cool?
So this study, what we did was this took about a year for us to do. We conducted a scientific study to determine what percent of all classic video games are in release right now on the commercial market. We'll get into the kind of complicated whys of why we did this, but really it was to help the work that's being done by organizations like the Software Preservation Network and other libraries and archives to help push forward the cause of video game preservation in, academic settings, cultural institutions. Part of this battle has been needing to know kind of what the state of the commercial market is like for video game preservation. And, you know, it was always just anecdotal for a long time. It was always just, you know, people in the retro gaming community kind of knowing that you can't get most games. But now we've proved that with hard data and actual science.
And just for sort of like a broad, you know, to put it really broadly, you know, games are disappearing and everyone sort of intrinsically knows that. And it's very difficult to do anything about it legally. Like preservation institutions don't have a ton of rights when it comes to being able to save this stuff and preserve it and share it with people, at least in any sort of useful way. So in order to push the entirety of video game preservation forward, we have to actually obtain those rights. And obtaining those rights requires convincing the U.S. Copyright Office, which requires some hard data. Hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting aspect of this whole project as, copyright law. Because there is an exemption process for archives and libraries that gets carried out every few years. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So the short version, we can get really in the weeds on this if we want to, but the short version is within the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which, you know, everyone loves, there's actually a really cool part of it where in the section that has prohibitions against, like, anti-circumvention, digital lock-breaking, breaking DRM, that sort of thing, there's a provision that says, you know, we know this is going to be a pretty stringent law, and every 3 years, there's a mechanism where people can basically petition the Copyright Office to say, hey, we need some new exemptions for doing XYZ. And that can be anything from, like, you know, we need to break DRM on our tractors to be able to repair them, all the way to, like, you know, we need to break copy protection on DVDs in order to rip them for preservation reasons in libraries. So for the last decade, there's been a big push to do more of this in libraries and archives, specifically with video games. And it's been a lot of incremental steps over the last decade, getting exemptions like, hey, if a single-player game needs to connect to a server to authenticate itself, and that server goes down, we should be able to break that copy protection to preserve this game in an archive. And it's been a lot of good incremental progress over the years. But consistently, every time this happens, the video game industry shows up and opposes it when, you know, new ones are being proposed. Once they're actually accepted, the opposition kind of disappears. But when we're first proposing them, there's always this pushback. And the notion of it is that, yeah, there is this growing market for video game reissues that, you know, you see there's things like, Digital Eclipse, Limited Run, other similar companies, Night Dive Studios that are going out and putting out more and more of these, you know, games that previously had not been re-released. And the game industry's argument is basically, look, like this, you know, more of these things are getting reissued. This happens all the time. Companies are making decisions to recommercialize their back catalogs constantly. And if libraries and archives have, you know, broader exemptions to do game preservation and make their collections more easily available to people, that's going to impact, you know, our market and our right to make money off of our titles. And the problem is that, again, I said this has all been anecdote, but yeah, it's we're kind of just like shouting anecdotes back and forth at each other. That it's like the game industry says, hey, all these games are going to be available pretty soon. And then the gaming community says, no, they're not. And that just kind of goes back and forth forever. So it's like, okay, we need to, the next time we have one of these hearings and we're petitioning for these new exemptions, we need to come armed with actual information. We need to kind of settle the debate on this and be like, all right, this is the reality of what the reissue market looks like. And the fact that there are games getting released, but it's really just kind of like, you know, a drop in the bucket. So that's where we see this fitting in, is kind of helping make the argument that we need more tools to do preservation in ways besides just, you know, people pirating things and sharing it on torrents and that kind of stuff. Like, what can we do legally through like actual institutions whose job is to preserve things?
I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that, like, you know, piracy has been the backbone of preservation just historically for a very, very long time, and it has gone a very long way. But what we're starting to run into now is basically just, and Kevin, I know you ran into this a little bit too recently, where you are fighting up against like the interests of individuals, because you have people doing this work, you know, for free, not as part of an institution, just doing it because they care about it. It ends up being very limited to what they care about, you know, what they care about preserving. And so I can't remember exactly what it was. You'll have to explain, but there was some sort of something needed to be built for Bally Astrocade to work, to run on Mister or something along those lines, or MAME, or I can't even remember now. But
I can explain that one real quick. So I was doing some historical research into the Bally Professional Arcade, the Astrocade video game system, where the vast majority of the library for it is basically games made on cassette in BASIC or machine language in some cases, and they need to be loaded up through cassette interfaces. And MAME didn't support these until 2019 is when they finally added support. Keep in mind that, like, there was an emulator for this machine for a very long time before that point, and just no one realized that this was missing. There's a Mister Core for it that also does not have this feature. And, you know, I asked around in that community if anyone could add it, and the folks there were not particularly interested, even the person who wrote the core, so.
And that's one of those things where it's like, it's fair, it's totally fair for someone doing this work for free to not be interested in something. But that is, you know, that is where that there becomes a gap between what the individuals can do versus what like an institution might be able to do. Not that institutions are doing MAME specifically, but like it's a comparable thing where, you know, we start running into issues of, you know, there's just so many games. Now there's so much happening all the time that if there's not someone sort of championing it at the individual level, we risk losing it.
It ends up being this weird chicken egg situation where, like, you know, libraries and archives are institutions that exist that can do this work. Like, it might make sense for someone to get a grant to develop better emulation for the Astrocade. But it's a case where, you know, there's not a lot of work being done in libraries because the law is a little too stringent for what we need, and the law is a little too stringent for what we need because nobody's doing the work. And it's just like, how do we get out of that logjam? And I think this is the next step forward, is saying, like, here's the reality of the situation. We need more tools to actually do this work that's not being done commercially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just also thinking, you know, availability of things that have been preserved through, you know, illicit means, if you will. You know, if a site like Forest of Illusion goes down, say, with a recent example, where's all that stuff going to live? Well, I hope someone else backed it up. So that's kind of a situation in where having these existing archives that are legally allowed to do this kind of preservation work would be able to step in and fill in the gap
Yeah, I think the point of frustration I have is, like, yeah, a lot of great stuff happens, you know, within the community, within these worlds that are technically piracy, but I get frustrated when I see people kind of throw their hands up and say, piracy is the only way this is ever going to be solved, we're going to have to keep circulating the tapes, this is it. And that frustrates me because it's like, I don't want to consign and sort of forfeit, like, all of video game history to an area of, you know, legally dubious methods. And it's frustrating if you're, you know, a researcher and it's like, how do I get this game? It's like, all right, here's how to run RetroArch and here's the sketchy website to go onto to find PS2 ISOs. Like, that's awful. Like, that we should be doing better than that. We should be able to do better than that.
Yeah, and I think just the important thing to point out there is that it really just, when you want there to be good video game history, good video game research, and, you know, documentaries and articles and books and whatever that comes from people having access to video games and their history, you're starting from a very difficult position if you are saying that anyone who wants to do this work, sorry, you just kind of have to break the law. And I recognize that this is not, you know, piracy is not murder or anything. Like, it's not a horrible crime, but, like, it's still a very difficult place to start from when you're just saying that, yeah, if you want to study this stuff, you just better get comfortable technically breaking the law. And as Phil says, you know, we can do better than that. We can have other options, that aren't that. They've just been very difficult to do, which I think is part of why this study is so important, is because it's just the next, like, major, building block and sort of building that road, that admittedly more difficult road than piracy, but it's important.
Yeah. And, one thing that, I noticed looking through, a draft of this report is you talk a lot about how important video games are culturally speaking, you know, right up there with movies and books and, you know, television programs and the like. So do either of you want to speak to that particular framing in this report and in this project? Because I absolutely agree, because, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be on this podcast.
Well, it's funny. In the report, I think we lay out the argument, like, games are bigger than movies, blah, blah, blah. And then I think we say, like, we don't need to justify this anymore. This kind of speaks for itself. Like, we honestly didn't spend too much time on that because I think to anyone, it's obvious that games are an important part of culture now. Like, I think for the longest time, games have always been in kind of this insecure place where they have to keep making their case that they're important and that they should be taken seriously. But, like, there's been game exhibits at the Smithsonian and the big V&A exhibit. It's like, this stuff is taken seriously now. But I think what I've noticed is there is an imbalance in terms of the amount of interest and how much people take games seriously as an art form versus the resources going to preserving it, the resources going towards, you know, supporting that work and making sure we're able to do it legally. Like, that's where there's a gap, is copyright law is written in a way that makes it harder for games in a way that doesn't really exist right now for things like preserving film or preserving books or, you know, those other mediums. So I think if there's really an issue, it's the gap there, I think.
And Lord knows books and film have gone through their own trials by fire in terms of preservation over the centuries.
And we'll be
literally.
And we'll be talking about that later on in this podcast, I think.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I mean, you know, games are quote-unquote lucky in that they are, or maybe unlucky, I guess, in that they are a just way newer art form than all of these other ones. I mean, I've never had to, my response to, you know, why are video games important or worth saving or whatever is just to be like, well, why is art worth saving? Why are books? Why is any, you know, like, it's all the same thing. And I think just because it's such a new medium, you sometimes get some people who, you know, maybe don't think of it in that way yet. And when you're writing a report for the U.S. Copyright Office, you know, you gotta make sure that you put that in there, right? That, like, just so you know, this actually is legit. Like, this is a huge industry. It's not just something, you know, kids play anymore. This isn't a toy. But I think that just widely, and certainly anyone listening to this podcast already knows that video games are culturally important, and they probably don't need to be convinced.
So I guess we should get into the report itself. I guess it's as good a time as any. So you said that you worked on this for about a year, and you wanted to do this specific study on the availability of old video games. So once you decided, okay, this is what we're going to do, how did this come together? Like, because I know you didn't do it all alone, just the two of you.
Yeah, we've had a really good partner on this one. With a group I mentioned earlier, the Software Preservation Network, which is it's sort of an affinity advocacy group for cultural heritage institutions doing work with software preservation. So they do a lot of work in terms of developing best practices, helping nurture this professional community, but also doing a lot of this legal advocacy work. They're the ones who are often at the forefront of what's happening with these petitions for new copyright exemptions. So, I had been serving with them for some time, and the last cycle go-around we had when the game industry did their usual thing of raising a stink about, that there's this market that already exists, that seemed like a fit where it's like, hey, we should talk. Like, the Video Game History Foundation has expertise in this subject and knowing how to find this information, and y'all have expertise in, like, writing reports and doing things through legal channels. So we worked with a lot of folks from there. In particular, I want to give a huge shout out to Claire Fox from Spin, who was just kind of involved in every step of this process, just helping us develop our methodologies and how we're going to write this report and, doing copy editing checks and making sure what we're saying made sense. It was actually really exciting working with Claire and Spin because, they don't come from a game background. They come from, a preservationist background. So there would be things like in the report we would mention, Metal Gear Solid 2 is a widely acclaimed game. And it's like, can we cite this? It was like having to explain I think things that the gaming community takes for granted, having to Doom came out on a lot of consoles. Like, let's explain that and get some citations down for it. Like, it was fun to have to explain, how a game emulator works. It makes the report easier for someone to read. But the big part really was we all kind of collectively developed this methodology of, like, what's going to be useful for us to do for this report. So working with Spin, in particular, the law and policy group that had a lot of thoughts of what would be useful, we came up with this plan for how we were going to tackle this thing. The idea was we could do the statistical work to figure out of all classic video games, how many of them do we need to study to get an accurate portrait of how many of these things are actually in release. So I think we ended up doing 1,500 games released before 2010, which was enough to get us within about 2 percentage points in our final results. We realized that, not all games get re-released equally, I guess is the way to put it. That, it's a big factor in whether games get re-released is whether the console is supported. Something like the Nintendo Entertainment System, there's obviously a lot of open source emulators for. Nintendo has their Nintendo Switch Online service versus something like, the Commodore 64, which the rights are split up between so many companies, and there's not really any commercially viable emulators people can easily use. So we came up with this idea of, in addition to kind of studying all classic games as a field, we were also going to study these kind of individual platform ecosystems, as we call them, and trying to look at a range of activity where it's like, let's look at an abandoned platform like the Commodore 64. Let's look at a really active platform like the PlayStation 2. There's a lot of PS2 games coming out all the time, getting re-released. A lot of, the big hits always coming out on PlayStation Plus Premium or just independently on Steam. A lot of those things are always getting pushed back out in the world. But then we also decided to look at a neglected ecosystem where it's like, okay, there's interest in this platform, but not a lot of games are getting released. And there's actually probably availability is getting worse over time, because I feel like a lot of platforms are kind of in that state right now where it's like, yeah, some things are getting released, but it's just not, the industry is not putting their full energy behind it. And for that one, we looked at the family of Game Boy consoles, the Game Boy, Game Boy Color, and Game Boy Advance, because in that case, it was like, the 3DS and Wii U eShops, when they shut down, they took down the virtual consoles. That took hundreds of virtual console games out of circulation. I think it ended up being 120 Game Boy games fell out of circulation when that happened. So it was a matter of like, okay, so this is a console there's clearly interest in. Nintendo still has their Switch Online service, but like availability is going down and there's not, it's kind of, there's a limited amount of places where you can really get Game Boy games. So it was like, yeah, let's look at this specifically too, just to give a kind of portrait of like what these different types of gaming re-release worlds look like. So we came up with those. Yeah, go on.
And I'm just going to jump in real quick to say that these are all specifically U.S. releases because we are dealing with the U.S. Copyright Office. So this is all games that were released in the United States. And when we say classic video games, we picked 2010 as our cutoff point, which is just, you know, sort of the as digital distribution starts getting bigger and, you know, we're out of the current console generation. At that point, you know, these are games that have ostensibly fallen out of release at this point. So everything in this study is released in the U.S. and from earlier than 2010.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to ask why 2010 was the cutoff. And
we are not here today to litigate whether the 360 is a retro console.
Yeah, I mean, like when you're building a study, you know, you have to just make some decisions with that stuff, and there's some other decisions we'll talk about later, I'm sure, too, like how we define what, you know, a remake is and all of that stuff. But you simply have to be clear, and so some of these might be, you know, cutoff points that we don't necessarily seek to like defend with our lives. It's just the best place to cut it off for the purpose of a study, you know, like we are not saying that 2009 means retro. We are just starting there because that's the good starting point.
And we're also not saying that games released in 2011 are in much better shape than ones from 2009 either.
Correct. Yeah.
Just gotta pick a date.
They're probably worse. But again, you have to design a study. You have to actually make some cuts like that. Otherwise it stops being scientific.
So, you had this 1,500 games, and those were chosen randomly, I understand, for your sample.
Randomly. We worked with the good folks at Moby Games. We wanted to keep all of our data sources to it. Like, we wanted to keep everything from one single data source. And it was like, out of all the game databases we looked at, Moby Games was just the most complete and had the most active community around it, where it felt like, yeah, this will be a reasonable representation. And obviously, there are games missing from that. We had some cases where we noticed that, but in terms of a random sample, I think it's still the best we can do in terms of just, you know, a complete list of games from that period. I think at the time we exported, it was 27,000 unique games from before 2010 was what I had in there. And that's a big span, too. That's going back as far as, like, you know, mainframe games from the 60s all the way up through DS releases.
Which we did get a few of in the study, which was kind of fun. There were definitely some things in there that popped up that you know, stretched the definition of what you might think of as a traditional video game. So yeah, mainframe stuff. I think you said there was a DVD game, DVD menu game in there.
Yeah, it was like a Simpsons trivia game for DVD. Yeah, because I think that, well, that was kind of intentional too. Not that we picked that intentionally because it was random, but it's kind of intentional that we cast that broad net because the industry is saying, you know, hey, you can get Mario Brothers. What's the problem? It's like, yeah, but can you get the Simpsons DVD game? That's a game too. Like, if we're going to talk about the medium, let's talk about the medium, right?
Yeah, I mean, what if I want to play that mainframe computer game where you play as Arnold Palmer's caddy while he's golfing?
What?
That's a real game. It's amazing. It's from like 1970.
Incredible.
Yeah. So for the platform specific things, were those also random samples?
Random for PlayStation 2 and Commodore, they were also random, and similar thing where we figured out, I think 400 games was how much we figured out we needed to do to get a good sample on those. For Game Boy, we decided to look at everything. Just because that was a case where after the eShop closures, like the state of the Game Boy market was in such a bad place that we just wanted to get a total population on that. It was like, I don't know. I think, you know, obviously we as the foundation kind of made a big deal about the fact that like, hey, these things shutting down, it's taking all these games out of circulation. So yeah, let's just get fully accurate numbers on this. And in that case, we went outside of Moby Games and started finding other Game Boy titles that weren't yet included in Moby Games or that we might have missed because the way we got data out of the database, we just wanted to make sure we were 100% complete on that one. Interestingly, I'd say most that Moby Games was missing was like Game Boy Advance tie-in games for like Nickelodeon shows, where it was like the Fairly Odd Parents game for Game Boy Advance or something like that. Because like what Kelsey was saying earlier, where like this stuff is driven by interest and like no one is super enthusiastic about cataloging Ratatouille for Game Boy Advance. So like that's the kind of stuff where we had to fill in the gaps and make sure our data set was complete.
Bless you for your work on that front.
We do want to contribute some of those back to Moby Games when we get the chance to. I know they just have a big backlog of changes right now.
So I know I did some volunteering for this part, but would you like to walk us through the process of figuring out if each of these games was available?
Yeah, so this is a very big undertaking, and we should take a moment to shout out all the incredible volunteers who made this possible. People from the Video Game History Foundation's community, as well as the University of Washington's iSchool students, did a ton of work sifting through hundreds of games and determining, you know, whether or not they were actually in release. And I you know what, I'm just going to pull up my instructions real quick because it's been a while since I've had to actually teach anyone how to do this. So, you know, what we're looking for here is that is whether or not games are currently in distribution in a way that the average person should be able to just obtain it. And it's usually through purchasing, but sometimes some of these games are available for free, you know, they're streaming or something like that. So they must be available on a platform that is currently in production. So, you know, if Limited Run makes a Game Boy cartridge of something, but you can't buy a Game Boy anywhere, then that's still not really in production, because where are you going to get the Game Boy from?
I was going to say, or supported, like the 360 is out of production, but like you can still access the 360 store. So like that one seems fine. Like anything, sure. A platform that's still current. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think they still like do repairs on those stuff too. So, and then it also has to be, you know, for it to be considered the same game as the original one, it has to be functionally the same game, which sounds obvious, you know, like a faithful port or a remaster. But does not count for things like, let's say, the example we like to use is Game Boy, is a Mortal Kombat on the Game Boy is not the same game as Mortal Kombat in the arcades. Those are two very, very different versions of that same game. And Phil, you can probably do a little bit of a better job at explaining this, and sort of why we wanted to defer to the yes. Like if you weren't, basically what we instructed people was, if you weren't 100% sure if something counted, if this port of something or this, you know, remaster of something had, you know, few enough differences to be functionally considered the same game. We always try to give the game industry the benefit of the doubt. And this is, again, another place where I'll say this does not mean that we think that, you know, a remaster of a game is the same as being able to access the original game. But, you know, again, we are building a study here, and we need to make the argument as bulletproof as possible. And so when you are being kind to the game industry and saying, okay, well, you know, we can clearly see that you did at least attempt to port this game, remake this game, whatever. You've certainly done everything in your power to make it available. We are going to at least count that as they tried. It is in release for the purposes of the study, if not for the purposes of a researcher. Phil, I don't know if you want to explain that a little bit better.
Yeah, well, like Kelsey said, we didn't want to get into a situation where we're arguing balls and strikes. We wanted to look at the very broad picture with this. So we purposely made a definition. I think the term we used to set the line was, if two versions of a game are substantially different, if they're unique expressions of the same work, and if they're interchangeable for general research purposes, were kind of our tests to figure this out. So an example I love because it kind of shows the complexity here is Shadow of the Colossus for PS2. This one didn't come up in the study, but it's just a really great example. Shadow of the Colossus PS2, you know, it's its own game. It was remastered for the PlayStation 3, which, again, it's the same game, just better frame rate, resolution. And then it was remade entirely for the PlayStation 4, and that version is effectively the same game, but it's a new game, right? Like, it's not the same thing as the original, it's new art assets, even though it's very faithful to the original, that's a separate game. So we wanted to give credit to to publishers for, like, yeah, you are trying to keep the original thing in production. The PS3 version is the same thing as the PS2 version. We're not going to argue that, you know, changing the resolution changes the nature of the game. Someone could argue that, I'm sure, if they wanted to, but it was just like, yeah, let's give you full credit. We want this to be the best case scenario possible. So count that. But then if it's a remake, if it's a new work, that's not the same thing. A similar case is, like, you know, all the video games based on Monopoly, those are separate games. They still are the exact same game. They are still Monopoly, but they're different games by different teams and different people with their own unique creative expression. It's like, so those count separately. We had to draw the line somewhere, and it was really just like, if it's a version of the original game, that should count, and that's fine. Toward the end, I think we ended up with something in the neighborhood of a couple dozen titles that Kelsey and I just had to, like, sit down on a Zoom call and just, like, litigate for the entire day to figure out whether or not they were the same game. And it was weird cases. Like, there was one where it was a game that it was a first-person adventure game that got re-released on Steam, but as a new genre, where, like, it was the same game and the same scenes and story, but they just changed how it played into a different type of adventure game, where it was more like a text parser game. It's like, that's really strange. I don't think that's the same game anymore. So, like, there were a lot of edge cases like that, but for the most part, I think it was pretty cut and dry, even in a case like, not that this one came up, but, like, Sonic Origins Collection. I'm sure there are people who might say, you know, well, yeah, Sonic Origins was, like, a re-implementation of Sonic 1, and there's these very slight differences because they used the whatever engine, but it's like, that's Sonic 1. It's okay. Like, that's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, we'll give them a pass because they're clearly trying to keep some version of Sonic 1 in release that is faithful to the original.
And again, I mean, this study is not here to argue whether or not that is good enough for a researcher or, you know, good enough to call preserved. We certainly don't think so. You know, every version of a game is unique in some way. But in terms of, you know, when we're presenting something to the U.S. Copyright Office and you're going up against lawyers, you want to have an airtight argument. And that's basically why we lean that direction. So, you know, just to circle back to the beginning of your question, which was, you know, how did this work? We basically gave those instructions and gave people a list of places that, you know, they should be looking for these games, whether it's on, you know, the Nintendo eShop, on the PlayStation Store, on Steam, on GOG, on Evercade, on AntStream, on Luna, on PiePacker, which I think
they finally changed the name away from PiePacker.
It's like jam.gg now or something like that, right?
That is an improvement.
Anyway, so, you know, our volunteers went through and basically just manually looked up every single one of these games to see if there was a way that, you know, they could still get this game legally. You know, obviously 90% of these were also on ROM sites, but that's not what we're looking at, right? So we ended up with a big spreadsheet, two big spreadsheets, actually, that we, you know, we did two separate passes on the data so we could compare them and then looked through all the discrepancies. And we also manually checked all of the yeses because that's because it's important, you know, to make sure that this is as airtight and as scientific of a study as possible.
We had a section on the spreadsheet where people could leave comments about what they, you know, well, this is kind of in release, but maybe it's not the same game. And anytime anyone left a comment, it was like, okay, let's check that. Let's just make sure their hunch is right on this one. And yeah, there were some borderline cases, but again, like we said, we leaned on the side of yes just because we wanted to say, like, let's assume this is the best case scenario for preservation. What do the numbers look like?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. In a best case scenario for preservation, how bad is it still?
Oh, man. I know. I was assigned part of the Commodore 64 section as a volunteer, and that was dire, let me tell you. I think I had one yes in my entire section, and even that was kind of...
And was it AntStream?
No, it was actually it was a copy of LoadRunner that only was on mobile.
Okay.
On like smartphone platforms, and I'm like, what? What an odd place for the original LoadRunner to be.
All those original Electronic Arts titles and like anonymous British games about like potato chips that somehow got released in the U.S. Like, shockingly, those are not in print, right?
Yeah, well, or, you know, all those ports of arcade games like Street Fighter 2 or Galaxian on the Commodore 64. You know, Capcom and Namco are holding out on us.
If you're listening, listeners, please ask Capcom to add the Commodore 64 version of Street Fighter 2 to their next collection.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, why didn't that make it into, like, Street Fighter, the Street Fighter Anniversary Collection?
It's a trip. I think we need to have tournaments for that game.
I saw someone propose they should do, like, an anti-collection where it's, like, all the... It's, like, Street Fighter the movie, the game, and, like, the C64 version. Like, all the weird stuff that they don't want to talk about anymore.
Oh, I'd buy that.
That would rule, yeah.
As an aside, I was at Combo Breaker a couple weeks ago, and there was a booth selling stickers, and one of them was, like, Street Fighter with a question mark, and it was just all of the really, like... weird characters done up in stickers. Like, you had the guy from Street Fighter 2010, and you had Ingrid from Capcom Fighting Jam. It was a trip.
That's the stuff. Yeah,
yeah, that's the good stuff right there. So yeah, you did all this, and you compiled all this information together. What did you come out with? What were the results of this whole project?
Based on our study, out of games released in the U.S. before 2010, only 13% of those games are still in release, which is really bad. That's a pretty bad number. That's less than a fifth. And I think comparing it to other mediums that have faced preservation crises, like we mentioned, that is slightly above the availability rate of pre-World War II audio recordings and slightly below the survival rate of American silent films.
You know, just that thing that is the most famous thing for being lost, you know, like that's how dire this is. And this industry is not even that old. We're talking about an industry that is a fraction of the age of all of these other industries, and we've already lost as much as, I don't know, it is mind-blowing numbers here. I mean, for it to be 87% of video games, of classic video games, to be, I'm going to say critically endangered. I mean, existing on a ROM site is not fully preserved. It's just not, you know, it is something. It's saving us right now, but these are things that could continue to disappear further and disappear every day. 87%.
When your point of comparison is like the phonograph that Teddy Roosevelt was listening to, like, that's not good. That's a bad scene.
I was gonna say, when your comparison point is like BBC television recordings from the 60s. Ugh.
Yeah, I think the survival rate on Doctor Who episodes in general is higher than games, probably.
Yeah, I'd say of all the lost Doctor Who episodes that have been preserved since they did a count, they're doing pretty well for themselves compared to video games here, legally speaking.
Yeah, that's the thing. To be fair, they're not, like, permanently lost in the sense that in some cases you can probably, and you can probably get them on ROM sites. You can probably get secondhand versions in a lot of cases, but as we know, that's getting more and more expensive. We got a thing at the foundation recently that I loved, which was, it was a price chart from Funko from 97, and they had Little Samson selling for 99 cents. And it's like, okay, yeah, there was a point when you could easily get secondhand games for cheap. That's not the case anymore. Like, that's an extreme example. But, like, you know, we can't ask somebody to spend hundreds or thousands on rare games and consoles if they want to play something like that. It's absurd.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at, right now, your two options. Assuming a game came out physically at all, you have two options, which is to find it and purchase it secondhand and have the hardware to run it. Although, depending on how rare that thing is, It might not even be a matter of do you have the money. It might be a matter of, you know, can you even find one? And then your other option is piracy. And just in terms of being able to provide access to people, that's just a really bad place for things to be stuck in.
And there is a third option, too, but it's also not great. The third option is you can go visit a library in person and look at stuff. Like, Kevin, you've gone
assuming that they've actually done that work. So, I mean, that is another really good thing to bring up, is right now, the way the law stands and where we're stuck and what this study is going to hopefully fix legally is that, you know, what we can do with video games at a preservation institution, what they can legally do is they can digitize it. They can make a copy of it and, you know, break DRM or whatever to make an on-site copy. But they cannot share it unless you are physically on the premises. So if you want to play, you know, an RPG that a library or an archive or whatever has preserved, you are looking at traveling to this library, which, I don't know, might be the Strong Museum of Play. You might be traveling to Rochester, New York, and flying there and staying there. And then being in the library for, you know, minimum 40 hours while you play through this game slowly on their equipment, assuming they have the equipment for it. And that's it. Like, that is where we're stuck right now. And to be clear, like, libraries can lend books digitally. They can lend movies digitally. Like, you do not have to walk into a library and read the book inside the library. You don't have to watch the movie inside the library. You can get these digital versions of these things, and you can do this from the comfort of your own home, which I think, as we all know, is where video game history is studied. And, like, this is how this research and all of this is done. So those are your options right now. And I should add that because this is such a, you know, a stupid thing that helps no one, you know, to preserve video games and then make them come on site to the library to go study them, libraries aren't really doing much of it right now. And who can blame them? Like, who does it help? Who are they actually serving by doing that? And they want to, like, the librarians I've spoken to are like, yeah, we'd love to do more with preserving games and, you know, giving people access to them. But right now, you know, what we're allowed to do in terms of access is so limited that why would we put our resources towards it? So That's where we're stuck right now.
Yeah, this came up even with the video that Gerard the Completionist recently did with buying all the titles from the 3DS and Wii U eShops. A lot of the response we saw from that was people saying, why did you do this? I can just pirate those games. Who is this helping? And it's like, that's the point. Right now, the way to provide access to those things is there's a 3DS and you come visit us and you play the 3DS. And, like, that's not sustainable. That's ridiculous. Like, again, we have to do better than that.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, this is like a specific issue to video games. I believe the last DMCA exemption cycle said that libraries could do this for other kinds of software, but sort of left it vague as to what the definition would be here.
They in fact refused to define the difference between software and video games. So we are left to assume that the difference is whether or not you're having fun. That's what makes it a video game.
So don't have any fun with, you know, Corel Paint or whatever.
So looking at the actual law, this is in the, like, the Federal Registry. So it is 37 CFR 201.40 subsection 18. It says, computer programs except video games that have been lawfully acquired are no longer available, blah, 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 blah. So they just added except video games. So we are trying to change three words of the law is what all this effort we're putting in.
Oh.
Law's crazy.
So you had this overall availability rate that was pretty dismal. What were the availability rates for the specific platforms you were looking at, the Commodore, the PS2, and the Game Boys?
Well, before we even get into those, I want to talk about one other interesting sample we found, which was from our overall sample, 13%. We looked kind of by like more granular 5-year periods of like, you know, 90 to 94, 95 to 99, just to like see if there were any patterns. And pre-1985 games, it's below 3%, which is real bad. And it's particularly bad, but in a way that I think kind of shows why we can't depend on the commercial marketplace to solve preservation, because those are games that are increasingly primitive looking and difficult to play and don't have as much commercial value, like older Atari stuff, right? Like the kind of stuff you do in Atari Archive. It's like, I don't think the game where you try to run across the road as a chicken is ever going to get commercially reissued. And so it's a case where it's like, okay, the market has decided that 3% of those games have value. The other 97%, those are like foundational games to the start of the video game medium. Researchers like need that stuff, and it's clear that the game industry is not going to provide that to people.
Yeah, like pre-Space Invaders, the best you're going to get, I think, is Atari 50 has Pong, and it has Breakout.
It has Lunar Lander, and that was, I think, the only game from the 70s on our study that showed up as yes, because you can play Lunar Lander in Atari 50.
Yeah, like, which is ridiculous, because a lot of the companies that were making games in the 70s, like, they're gone, but Atari was a big one, and Midway was a big one, and, you know, Atari still exists in the world in some form, and Midway is owned by Warner, which ostensibly still makes video games through NetherRealm, and they have the rights to all these things, but they don't do anything with them. They just let them collect dust.
Yeah, and that, I think for us, that was really good evidence that, you know, this the interest of what, like, researchers need, what the preservation community needs, is different from what the commercial industry wants to supply us. So that was an important point I wanted to mention, but it kind of segues well into talking about the other consoles, specifically the Commodore 64, which is right in that zone of these archaic, obsolete games with low commercial value. We came back with 4.5% of Commodore 64 games are still in print. And that's got, you know, it's got a margin of error on it, but still pretty bad numbers. I think particularly bad because almost all of those came exclusively from AntStream Arcade. I think it was like something like 80% of those titles were from AntStream Arcade. If you removed AntStream from the equation, I think it would end up being like less than 1% are in print. And it's not good to have one, you know, startup essentially as the single point of failure for the entire Commodore 64 ecosystem. That's definitely not a sign of a healthy reissue market if it's just dependent on this one company. For the other ones, though, PlayStation 2, we thought was going to be much better, and unfortunately, that one ended up being only around 12%, which is actually lower than our overall sample. But again, margin of error, it's probably kind of on the higher end of things. It's still higher than Commodore 64. There's still clearly interest there, but just not a lot happening there, unfortunately. Again, that's even with like PlayStation Plus Premium and Squaresoft doing all their stuff. It's just, it's still low. And that then brings us to the Game Boy, which this one was really fascinating. The Game Boy ended up being about 5.8% of titles are still in release. The reason this was interesting, and I do want to mention that our data is as of April this year, so anything that's come out on, you know, Nintendo Switch Online since then isn't counted in the sample. But what we found was the number of games that were taken offline when the 3DS and Wii U virtual consoles shut down was greater than the number of games that were still available in any format for the Game Boy. So when those stores shut down, they took out the majority of all Game Boy games that were in release at that point in time. Which, again, it shows that like there's clearly commercial interest. They're still putting some of them out there, but they allowed that much of the marketplace to lapse. So it's like, again, we can't count on companies to be the ones doing this.
And I think it's important to note, or to reiterate even, that you were not counting games that were available on the 3DS or the Wii U for this project, because you know Nintendo already said they were shutting that down. So why even bother?
Yeah, we were doing the data gathering in the process of that happening. So yeah, we just assumed those would be closed by the time we published the study, which they were.
Yeah,
and in the same vein, we also, you know, anything that had been announced as being you know, will be available. We also included, as you know, we trusted companies who were saying this is coming, you know, even if it was 2 months after the study concluded, that's still included in there as available as well.
Yeah. And if I remember, you also cut out, you know, anything that might only have been available on the PS3 or the PS Vita shops, just because Sony's just kind of let those fall apart. Even though they're technically still around, you can't actually, like, buy anything on them unless you have an old account.
Well, this actually goes into, this was a weird enough thing for us, we actually kind of rewrote the report around talking about it. Kelsey, you can speak to the specific technical issues you ran into with this, because this was really unusual.
Yeah, so I was actually manually checking a lot of the the games that were, you know, supposedly available on the PS3, and I would not have even discovered this. I wasn't planning to discover this. I just decided to, you know, rather than signing in with my own account, just make a brand new account, just make it fresh for the purposes of this study, you know, just a Video Game History Foundation account. And what I discovered is that it sends you in sort of like an infinite loop of non-existent two-factor when you create a new account. So there, I did end up, you know, I went on Reddit and ended up finding some workarounds, which I don't exactly remember off the top of my head, but
there's like a secret page where you can generate a one-time use login code for PS3 or something like that. But yeah, it's not documented anywhere. And it's not clear that, like, that's why you couldn't access the store either. Like,
correct. Yeah. It's not like making it click. I can't remember exactly what it said, but it just kind of kept failing on me. Like, it just kept not working and not connecting. And, you know, I tried different PS3s. I tried a different internet, you know, moved it to another place and tried a different internet. And it ended up just being that new accounts are just not really supported with the infrastructure in the same way that old accounts are. And so Phil, I mean, you were the one who sort of talked through with the Software Preservation Network, you know, what that meant for the study. I was willing to be like, well, it's still technically in release, but I think they were more like, look, if you have to, you know, try two different PS3s and look up a workaround on Reddit, like, that doesn't cut it.
Exactly. The standard we used was the phrase reasonably available, which is a very vague phrase, but it's what's used pretty consistently in copyright law and even in the sections that we've been talking about for getting exemptions in. And in that case, I don't think that if you could, like, have to buy a PS3 login and you can't get the game, like, I don't think that's reasonably available. And I think it goes into a broader point we decided we wanted to make after this happened, which is that the volatility of digital marketplaces basically ensures that these things are not going to stay in release, and it may actually get worse over time. Digital marketplaces are really useful for getting more of these re-releases out there, because you don't have to manufacture product, you don't have to print discs and Switch cartridges, which, as we've seen, that's increasingly becoming kind of a limited collector market for these things. So it's easier to get these games out in broad distribution that way. But it also isn't a guarantee they're going to stick around forever, because you have the eShop shutting down, you have the PS3 and Vita stores just kind of disintegrating in real time. You have evidence that Microsoft was considering shutting down the 360 store this year, from that statement that kind of snuck onto the Xbox store page that somebody noticed. And I think it's, like, between that and the things we noticed with, like, you know, AntStream kind of carrying the burden for a lot of these things, it's just clear that it's like, you know, unless these things are continually getting re-released all the time and the rights are always being kept on top of, like, this is just going to get worse over time. I think we could imagine, you know, based on what the game industry said, a very rosy scenario where, like, there's more and more games getting reissued all the time. But we just don't know how long these things are going to stay in release. Like, once the Switch and the, you know, Xbox One and PS4 and all that shut down, like, are people going to still be porting these games to the next generation of platforms? What's the Windows update that's going to happen that's going to break compatibility with XP games? Like, there's a lot of those questions out there, and it's just like, it's just going to get worse over time. I think was another point we wanted to make with this, that right now this is kind of the best case scenario, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you mentioned the some of the legal issues, and that brought to mind you gave a couple examples in this report of games that had very thorny legal issues around them, like GoldenEye 007, I think the Scott Pilgrim game. Though both of those had managed to get reissued after years and years of people wanting them, because you had all these different companies that had these different rights, so they all had to work everything out. And then you also gave the example of No One Lives Forever, a game that was critically acclaimed and is also one people would love to see again, but the rights are split up in such a way that it's, a nightmare to try and untangle, and so no one's bothered.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple of big names where, the crowd gets loud enough that eventually they do figure out how to iron out the legal rights. But there are, for every Scott Pilgrim and every GoldenEye, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of examples of things that the legal rights are just way too messy to ever untangle, even if, the companies have every intention to and really want to re-release it. If some of that documentation has been lost, you just simply won't do the risky thing of assuming that you have the rights, or that you, that you're able to do something like that. So you have, of course, you have cases where companies no longer exist. You have cases where, no one really knows who owns what part of the rights, or they're just not really sure. They're not confident enough to be like, yeah, we're going to go re-release this thing and, it'll make us a couple million dollars, and then we'll get sued for a couple million dollars because some other company thinks that they actually have the rights to, this, this one part of the game or this music or this license or something along those lines. So, even under sort of the best intentions of the video game industry, the legal landscape just simply makes it impossible for the market, for the video game industry itself, to be able to keep everything in release. I mean, it just wouldn't be possible, even if money was no factor, or even if, willingness to do it was no factor.
Yeah, like going back to Ratatouille for Game Boy Advance, that was published by THQ, it was licensed from Disney. Do either of them really think it's worth the effort trying to sort all that stuff out? Like, it's never going to happen. I say that there's probably going to be, like, suddenly Ratatouille for Game Boy Advance getting re-released on Nintendo Switch Online next week or something like that. But, like, that's one of those cases where it seems like most games fall into the Ratatouille bucket. A really interesting thing we mentioned in the study is down at Stanford University Libraries, Henry Lowood has been working with a very extensive collection, the Stephen Cabernetti Collection, which was this very extensive collector of games and software in the, I think, through 95, I want to say. And, they think they got something like 18,000 unique titles in their collection. And they went on this big grant-funded project where they tried contacting the rights holder of every game to proactively seek permission to do preservation-related stuff around it. And in 20 to 30 cases, the rights holder couldn't confirm that they had the rights anymore to the game. And accounting for cases where they couldn't, like, reach the rights holder or it wasn't clear who they were, I think he said, like, half that collection was orphaned works. And that's bleak. So that's, half the collection is orphaned works, another 13% has been commercialized by the game industry, and then there's that other, what's that, like, remaining 37% that's just kind of in limbo. It's like, this is not a healthy market. This is not a sign of something that's going to be solved through commercialization.
No. And there's the technology, side of things, too. You have to make sure if you're reissuing a game, do you have the source code? If not, do you have a good emulator? Is it a piece of hardware that can be emulated very well? Does it have a funky control scheme you have to figure out how to implement with a standard, Xbox controller or what have you?
Or there, I think there's a case like NFL Blitz we mentioned in the report, where it's like that game has been reissued, but they had to go in and modify it to remove all the violence. And it was like, all right, you had someone on staff who I don't even know if they had access to the source code or not, but like had to hack the 1997 version of NFL Blitz to get in compliance with what the NFL wanted. Like, it's absurd that like that's what you have to do in order to get something re-released.
And that's a reissue of an arcade one-up, like an arcade cabinet that's a few hundred dollars, and that is also not viable.
That's if you want to research NFL Blitz, you have to pay a couple $100 to get the version with all the content taken out that people actually liked.
Or I guess, or find an arcade that still has one of that specific, like,
yeah, it's like, age. Oh, you want to research this, you got to go to Galloping Ghost in person, like it's Mount Rushmore, and you have to see it yourself. It's ridiculous.
And you better hope that it's working.
That too, yeah.
Were there any particular surprises for you when you were doing this project? Like, any games that were available that you didn't expect to see, or vice versa, or just, like, overall numbers?
Huh.
Or companies?
I have to think about that, because I wasn't really as hands-on as much with the games. I think the PS2 was one of the biggest surprises for me, the fact that that was so low, because that one really seemed like it was going to be, you know, a best-case scenario for, like, there is a big multi-billion dollar company putting energy and effort behind getting more of these games out. They have their own emulation platforms running across, you know, PS4 and PS5 and PS3. People are doing these things independently. People obviously like games from this generation. And I was shocked that one was as low as it was. I don't think there were a lot of positive surprises. I think the cases where there were tended to be like a thing that was released as open source that somebody else put on, like, the Google Play Store or something like that. Like, Glider for Macintosh. That was a nice, pleasant surprise. But that's, I think generally it was mostly disheartening. It was mostly like, oh, wow, really, this thing isn't in release? The only way to get God of War 2 right now is through the PS3 store that kind of doesn't work. That's weird to me.
I mean, it's hard to be excited about any individual games when the overall landscape is so bad. I mean, like, I'm glad that Nintendo keeps, like, Super Mario Brothers in release, as they should, but, like, it all pales in comparison to what the, you know, the bleakness of the overall landscape, you know? Like, there are some important games that are still in circulation. That's great. I don't feel like that's easy to celebrate when you look at it against everything else. I will say that I actually am surprised that 13% of games are in release. I mean, when we went into this project, I predicted it would be even worse. So it's a little better than I thought it was going to be. But that, again, when you're talking about, like, the difference between 10% and 13%, like, either way, that's abysmal. I think I might have been excited if it was like 40%, but we all knew that wasn't going to be the case. So
no, I'm right there with you. I was expecting much worse numbers than 13, which I guess there's a margin of error. I guess the real number might be lower than that.
That's like, oh, you left one of my fingers instead of cutting off five of my fingers. Like, wow, great. Thanks. Super. Thanks so much. But I think you mentioned companies, though, as that we're surprised by. And I think that's interesting, because we didn't study companies specifically because they just got into too much of a granular breakdown. And, like, you know, I think there were, you know, in the overall sample, if there were, like, you know, maybe 20 Nintendo games or something like that, that's still, you know, that's one of the biggest publishers. It just wasn't going to be useful to break it down that way. But what we noticed, and I think what we proved with the study, is that this is a problem across the entire industry. That this isn't, people always blame Nintendo and say, oh, Nintendo does such a bad job keeping this stuff in print, or, you know, oh, it's legally, you know, it's morally right to pirate Nintendo games and all this stuff. And it's like, you know who's also bad about it? Microsoft and Sony and Capcom and Square and literally every company. This is the entire industry is bad about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just remember looking through all of those Commodore 64 games and all of these ones from Electronic Arts and thinking, wow, if any of these are on there or still available, it's going to be on GOG and they're going to be like the really crummy 80s DOS versions. So
exactly.
That was always super.
Exactly. It's distressing that this was, you know, Commodore 64 in particular was such a big platform for so many developers in that era, and they've just kind of chosen to move on from it, I think is weird. And I think, again, telling about where the commercial interests of the industry are, and it leans towards profit and not preservation.
Yeah. Which brings us all the way back around to why it's important that other archives and libraries and such are able to do this work for, you know, not trying to make profit off of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the points we wanted to make with this is that, you know, as much as it's easy to say, like, yeah, if the industry's mission was to say we're preserving history, you know, they've obviously failed spectacularly at that. But I think it's also not fair for us to expect that from these companies. You know, they're interested in selling you a PS5 and the newest version of Madden. Their job isn't to preserve their own history and keep it commercially available. They're companies. They have stockholders. Like, that's not their business. But we do have institutions that can do this work, and they are libraries and archives, and they don't have the tools they need to do the job.
Well, and I think, like, as far as I know, and I'm not a subject matter expert in this, but as far as I know, there is not an industry where it's, like, on the marketplace to do a fantastic job at preserving, you know, the entire industry. Like, that's not the job of an industry. In any industry. That's not the job of the music industry. That's not the job of the movie industry. I mean, that's why preservation institutions exist, is because, you know, capitalism kind of inherently is not friendly to this kind of work. So, you know, it's less screw the game industry and more like, let's just do what makes sense for every other type of media, probably makes sense for this type of media too. And then I think, you know, it will still suck, but like, it might not sting so bad to lose the eShop when there are libraries and archives that can just give you access to those games, you know, for your own purposes. Like, if you want to check out a game that has been delisted or whatever, and you are just simply able to do that in a legal way, then it won't be as big of a deal when, you know, when an eShop shuts down. But because we don't have anything, we have no safety nets for that kind of stuff, besides piracy, like, of course that's scary.
Mm-hmm.
We were thinking about kind of what our ask was coming out of this report, and originally it had some very flowery language in there about, like, the industry and libraries must work together to solve this problem. And Claire from Spin left some comment that was just like, really? Like, is that that's your takeaway from this? Like, this unrealistically rosy scenario. And so what we ended up saying was, like, we just want the game industry to acknowledge this, that, like, the reissue market has only gone so far, it's only going to be able to go so far, and it's not their job to do it. There is a hole in the there's a gap in the world of preservation, and it's up to, you know, libraries and archives to fill that gap, and they need to, if not support us, then at least just get out of the way and stop opposing us from asking for these reasonable things that'll let us preserve the games that the industry is clearly not interested in working with.
Yeah, that sort of segues. I was curious, do you have any sort of follow-up study in mind? Are there any outstanding questions that you think folks should be looking into further? Or are you just focused in on the next DMCA exemption process?
I think the exemption process is the next thing on everyone's radar for sure, but it does raise a lot of questions that I think there's room to expand on, just because now we have some very base level of data to work with, you know, questions about, like, all right, what do libraries and archives already have? How much of the collections of libraries and archives are out of print versus still in print? Just kind of sussing out a little more about, like, okay, you know, what things are actually out of print? What platforms need the most support? You know, what platforms don't have great emulation states right now? What can libraries contribute the most to? Now that we have some very base level understanding of the stuff and some very broad standards to apply for, like, you know, what counts as in release or not, I think there's a lot we can continue to explore in terms of where library collections as they stand fit into the picture. Kind of the stuff that, like, Henry Lowood was doing with the Cabernetti collection. We don't have anything specific in mind, but I know we've sent some feelers for ideas off to other researchers we've been interacting with on this project for them to explore stuff on their own. But I think the focus now is we have some really strong ammo going in to further discussions about this, where it's like, all right, we've kind of reset the terms of debate here. Now we have some data. Let's kind of start this conversation over. And that's what's going to be happening over the next year. The DMCA process has just started this month. The Copyright Office put out their notice of like, hear ye, we're beginning to ramp this up and are looking for your comments. So I think that's going to be the next year of this process. And VGHF is not going to be at the very front with a banner during this thing. The Software Preservation Network, you know, folks at Harvard Cyber Law, they're the folks who really know how to get this stuff done, but we will absolutely be championing them and providing support where it makes sense. Because again, I think this conversation's been missing people with subject area expertise who like really know the gaming world. I think that's what's been really fun, has been taking what we know from like our years in the gaming community and applying it in a setting where there's like lawyers who know how to translate this into stuff that can actually, you know, affect real change.
I think this has been like a beautiful bridge between institutions because, yeah, as you said, you know, we have sort of the subject matter expertise, and are able to, you know, do a project like this that's able to help, in turn, help their lawyers do the actual lawyering, which is, you know, not our strength internally here. But the other part too is being able to, you know, I think we're fairly good at being able to, explain these sort of, semi-complex legal landscapes and bring them back out to the public and try to give people in the video game world a better understanding of like why things are the way they are and how they could change and what we're doing about it. Which is, you know, it's just one of those things where I just don't think those worlds intersect very often. You know, you don't have a lot of like lawyers getting on podiums and doing a call to the masses on a podcast kind of thing. So I think it's been a really awesome sort of exchange of expertise here to be able to help move the law forward with our expertise and also be able to kind of understand what they need and what the needs of sort of the legal landscape are and share that, hey, that stuff's going to start changing pretty soon.
I do think it is, I want to riff out what you're saying about, how this is really good in terms of two-way communication. It was really funny. We were, recording a podcast yesterday with, one of the legal advisors at Spin. And the thing he was really excited about with the report, besides the data, was just the fact that we've, like, written down and described, like, hey, it's hard to emulate games, and sometimes you don't own the rights to a game, and you license the content for it, and it's different than film is. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, I don't think it really occurred to us until doing this that, like, that's not really written down somewhere in a way that lawyers can refer to. It's just kind of been stuff we've all kind of ambiently known being, you know, waist-deep in games for our entire lives. so it's been great to kind of open those channels in both directions.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of the topic. Is there anything either of you would like to bring up that we didn't touch on that you feels important?
I guess I just want to reiterate that this would not have been possible without the support of people in the Video Game History Foundation's community, both volunteer efforts and then also, of course, you know, we are a 501c3 nonprofit, so we are almost entirely driven by individual donors. You know, we don't have a wealthy billionaire benefactor or anything. This is truly just a like a groundswell movement from people who care deeply about video game history and about video game preservation. So we literally could not do it without you. And it's a very huge deal to be kind of making history with this step here. So thank you to everyone.
And Phil, did you have anything?
I feel like I shouldn't say anything after that. It's a very good point to end on.
Okay. So in that case, this has been a Retronauts podcast. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/retronauts. And there's a good chance if you're listening to this, you already are. So thank you very much. Supporters can get episodes 1 week early at $3 a month, and at the $5 a month level, you get bonus episodes on alternating Fridays, Diamond Fights This Week in Retro Columns, and access to the Discord server, which has lots of very cool people. You can also find us on Twitter at Retronauts and on our website, retronauts.com. So thank you for listening. Folks, is there anything you would like to promote? Where could folks find you online?
Yeah, you can follow the Video Game History Foundation. Our website is gamehistory.org, where you'll be able to read, you know, a lot more about the study. You can read the study in its entirety, as well as, you know, some additional thoughts and things on it, but that's a great place to kind of keep up with what the foundation is doing. We're also at Game History Org on Twitter and pretty much all social medias. I am personally at Kels Lewin on Twitter and at Kels Lewin on Blue Sky.
And since Kelsey's already covered the Video Game History Foundation, I'll just throw a grenade into this conversation as we leave and say, I think Final Fantasy VIII is the best Final Fantasy game, and I'll just leave on that note and just let the podcast deal with that.
Whoa. That's an opinion. And as for me, you can find me on YouTube at Atari Archive. I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus. I have a Patreon to support my video under Atari Archive. I've got a book that just came out, also called Atari Archive Volume 1, through Limited Run Games. So thank you again for listening, and thank you to Phil and Kelsey for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.